ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's been a turbulent day for Australia's newest passenger airline. Bonza has cancelled all its flights and gone into administration. So is it really possible to run a budget airline in regional Australia? More on that in 1 minute. And
they stole the water pistons, which is basically the main driving mechanism for these, and subsequently sold them to a scrapyard.
If you live in a regional area and leave your vehicle, farm machinery or properties unlocked, think again. Police are reporting an increase in rural crime. That's up in 7 minutes. G'day, Jono Kendall here on Gunai Kurnai Country in Sale, Victoria, broadcasting on your radio, online and the ABC Listen app. This is Australia Wide. Regional air travellers have been left stranded after budget airline Bonza cancelled all its flights and went into administration.
Meant to be flying home. We've just put our son on a plane to go live in London and we want to go home, and I've just got here and some airport man out the front said, "Your flight's cancelled." I've come in and I can't find anyone to talk to.
Pretty stunned, actually. So I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do. I mean, I know Qantas is the only other airline that flies to Tamworth.
What can you do? We're supposed to be going home back to Rockhampton, but then we've got to travel a bit further. But what can you do? These things happen, so it's a case of trying to find out what our next step is.
The Transport Workers Union says Qantas is partly to blame. Here's the union's National Secretary, Michael Caine.
We have to support companies that are trying their best to carve out a good future for Australia in the aviation sector, servicing regional communities. This is a very large island. Aviation is critical infrastructure, and we've got an aviation industry that's broken. Today, we've got passengers left stranded again and workers with their jobs on the line yet again. It's Ansett, it's Virgin getting back in the air by the skin of its teeth, and now we've got this company trying to do the right thing who is in the lurch. And it's because this aviation sector is broken. It's a market that's broken. It's dominated by the monster in the room of Qantas that's doing everything wrong and reaping in the profits as a result.
Well, Geoffrey Thomas is an aviation industry analyst. G'day. Can a regional budget airline work in Australia?
The business model that Bonza had is good because they were connecting cities, in most cases, that are currently not connected. So if you want to travel, from A to C, typically you've got to go through B, Sydney or Melbourne. They were connecting, A and C and D and X and various cities that are simply not connected. That's a business model that's been proven in the United States and in Europe that actually worked. I think, the team at Bonza are great. The aeroplane was fine. They're very professional. The issue is, I think the rug has been pulled from underneath them by a change of ownership.
Yeah, okay. Although there have been a few problems with Bonza. So since launching, Bonza has faced criticism for cancelling flights, including mass cancellations over Christmas, and then suspending routes as well. So it hasn't all been smooth sailing for Bonza.
Look, absolutely spot on. It hasn't been. And there's reasons for that. They were expecting to get more aircraft. They didn't arrive as promised. And then one of the aircraft they had received from Canada had not gone onto the Australian register, and there was complications with that. So they had anticipated getting delivery of aircraft. That didn't materialise for various reasons. So services were cancelled or suspended, or new routes were suspended. So yes, there was certainly some turbulence there. But this latest hiccup, I think, is somewhat unrelated to that, but nonetheless involves ownership of aircraft.
So Bonza was flying from the Sunshine Coast, was based on the Sunshine Coast, to places like Mildura, Cairns, Mackay, Townsville, the Whitsundays, Coffs Harbour, Newcastle, Port Macquarie, Albury and Rockhampton. I mean, what does that mean for tourism in those places to have Bonza cancel its flights?
Look, it's certainly a blow. Hopefully other airlines like Rex, Qantas and Virgin Australia will try and fill the gaps. What it means is the passengers who were going to go between those different points will probably have to go via somewhere else, like the way they used to. But certainly it's a blow, because the Bonza model was all about creating a new market with very low fares, encouraging people who hadn't flown before to fly, because people love to go non-stop. So there will be an impact. Mind you, you know, their share of the market was very, very small.
A Sunshine Coast man whose wife works for the airline has told ABC Radio that about 20 crew were called into a meeting early this morning, and there were two crews there, and they were basically told that Bonza has finished. Do you think the business model would work in Australia? You said that that business model has worked in the States, but is there the volume of passengers in Australia to make that work?
Well, certainly, you know, you're right. The volume in America and the volume in Europe is much, much greater, and this model works really well. But, of course, you're talking about an airline like Allegiant. They've got over 100 aircraft. Bonza was looking to have about 20 aircraft. That was, I think, was where they were sort of headed. And from that perspective, you know, the market would be, they could do it. And there's lots of places that aren't connected in this country, like, for instance, that still aren't connected, like Adelaide to Broome, for instance. If you want to go from Adelaide to Broome right now, you have to go via Perth or via Darwin. So there's lots of places that aren't connected that could be connected.
You're saying that there were some significant problems with leasing of those aircraft, but how much blame can be laid at the feet of Qantas and Virgin for the for what looks like the, you know, the collapse of Bonza?
I don't think that any blame can be laid at their feet, because Bonza was not competing on any routes, virtually no routes that Qantas or Virgin were operating on, and that was part of their model. The model is, we're not competing with these guys. We're keeping to ourselves. We're not going to tackle them on Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, or any of those key routes. We're doing the routes they don't want to do. You know, aviation is a very cruel industry when it comes to surviving. But there's always entrepreneurs out there that love the smell of aviation fuel. You know, they think they can make it work.
Geoffrey Thomas, an aviation industry analyst and editor-in-chief of airlineratings.com.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Sometimes in the country, we get lulled into a false sense of security. It's picturesque and peaceful in much of regional Australia, and we can end up thinking crime is something that happens in big cities a long way away. Well, police are reporting an increase in rural crime rates, as farmers in particular are targeted for their valuable machinery and equipment. Grace Whiteside reports.
You feel violated, basically. You're vulnerable, aren't you? And farmers are vulnerable. There are numerous access points, and it's in a quiet area, so to speak.
After 60 years on their sugarcane farm at Farnsfield, south of Bundaberg, Geoffrey Plath and his family are at their wits' end. It's not because of a natural disaster, unusual weather, or the price of sugar.
Some trespassers and thieves accessed the property and vandalised and damaged five of our travelling irrigators, and they stole the water pistons, which is basically the main driving mechanism for these, and subsequently sold them to a scrapyard.
The colossal watering structures are crucial to the Platts' operation, but some parts aren't replaceable, and a new irrigator can cost upwards of $40,000.
We're in a fully irrigated area here, and we do have particularly dry spells, and then some of those irrigators run continuously for, you know, up to 3 months at a time. So that's the potential impact in the future about not being able to irrigate crops when needed.
We are definitely seeing increases in rural crime.
Chief Inspector of the Bundaberg Patrol Group, Grant Marcus, says there's been a 15 to 20% jump in farm crime compared to this time last year.
They're looking for properties where they can, first of all, steal a four-wheel drive and try and locate any sort of trailer that they can use. And from there, they're using those vehicles to literally steal whatever they can. Things like power tools, looking for guns, unfortunately, but motorbikes and quad bikes and even Polaris vehicles.
It's put the agricultural community around Bundaberg on edge. Mr. Plath has been checking on farm machinery late at night, something his wife Judy dreads.
I worry about his safety a lot. And if he comes across someone, what are those people willing to do to get themselves out of trouble? But you also feel powerless to do anything about it.
Our surveys show about 80% of farmers have experienced some form of crime on their farm in their lifetime.
That's Carl Mulrooney, the co-director at the Centre for Rural Criminology at the University of New England in New South Wales.
A very low risk and very high reward, right? You've got lots of great rewards for offenders on farms. Really expensive machines, very expensive tools. Stock is $2,000 or more walking around on four legs. But you don't have very many people around to see you commit the crime. And so you're in this environment that the scales are really tipped in favour of the offender.
His research has revealed a startling fact. Some farmers don't bother reporting crime.
The primary reasons is that they don't have much confidence that anything can be done about it. It's a very difficult context in which to solve crime, and farmers are kind of aware of that, and so they often just don't bother reporting because they don't have confidence in the outcome. The police don't know what's going on. They can't do anything about it. And it almost starts this really, I guess, vicious cycle in which the farmers don't think the police can do anything about it. The police don't have the information to do anything about it. So then they don't report, and it just sort of goes on. And we're really left with no clear picture of farm crime victimisation.
The message from Chief Inspector Marcus is clear. Lock up, look out, and let police know.
The reality is these days, unfortunately, farmers can't leave their sheds open. They can't leave their houses unlocked. They can't leave their keys in the ignition of their cars or anything like that, or on their workbench. And that's unfortunate, but that is the world we live in.
Chief Inspector of the Bundaberg Patrol Group, Grant Marcus, ending that report from Grace Whiteside.
ABC Australia Wide.
You're listening to Australia Wide. Remember, you can always email us. We'd love to hear what's happening in your part of the world. australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. The Greek diaspora of Port Pirie is the second oldest Greek community in Australia and the oldest in South Australia. This year is its 100th anniversary, and to mark the occasion, local historian Nick Sandanis has published a book detailing the highs and lows of life in Port Pirie for the Greek community. ABC Port Pirie reporter Vicky Natarfalos met him.
John Sandanis spoke no English and only had the clothes on his back the day he took a risk that would change not only the course of his own life, but the next two generations of his family. In April 1954, the Pioneer had docked in Port Pirie, South Australia. Seven Greek sailors, including John, jumped ship and ran for it. Here's his son, Nick Sandanis.
They had to hide in the Flinders Ranges for 22 days. There was the remnants of the Morgan Whaler pipeline, and they sat in those pipes on rocks. If you got caught before the ship left the harbour, you're in handcuffs back on the ship.
Mr. Sandanis says the men's brazen bid to start a new life in Australia was made possible through the kindness of local man Bill Frangos. He offered to hide the men from the authorities on his farm in the neighbouring town of Nelshaby. Little did John know, this connection would lead him to his future wife, Irini.
My mum is Uncle Bill's sister. So Uncle Bill was looking after this 20-year-old guy who met my mum. They got married January 55 and I was born in December 55.
After the Pioneer left the port, the group emerged from hiding and turned themselves in at the police station. They paid a £10 fine and were subjected to a good behaviour bond before later being naturalised. The migrant story of the Sandanis family is one of the many Mr. Sandanis has written about in his recently published book, History of Greeks in Port Pirie, celebrating 100 plus years. The Greek club was founded in 1924, but Mr. Sandanis found the first Greek in Port Pirie arrived in 1861 from Crete. He says Miltiadis Dimitrios Bizanis had to flee his homeland real quick after he was involved in the murder of an Ottoman Turk, so he became a merchant seaman and eventually came to South Australia.
When he was naturalised, they asked him if he wanted to anglicise his name, and he had a bit of a think, and he said Dear, but because his name was Dimitrios, he wanted Miltiadis D, so he emphasised the D, Dear. He was a very fast runner, as a young man in Crete. And in the village, he'd earned the nickname Elafi. Now, Elafi in Greek means a deer, a fast-running animal. But the Didiers were the first Greeks in Porphyry.
To this day, the local Greek club is still on Florence Street, where the book was launched earlier this month. The town's Greek Orthodox Church is also still there, just across the road. Kula Korniatakis is the club's secretary and Mr. Sandanis' sister. She helped with researching and editing and typeset the whole book. Ms. Korniatakis says the club is still going strong, having adapted to the modern community.
We've got a mixed lot of people that are all ages. It's very close. We try and have a lot of multicultural events, and we still honour a lot of holy days.
Former local, Amalia Vosnakis, says she made the 2.5-hour drive from Adelaide to attend the book launch.
We used to go to Sunday school and Greek school, and then we'd have to do our Greek poems on national days and do our Greek dancing. Every Sunday there'd be a soccer match, and after the soccer match we'd have a barbecue, and that meant food and dance. Even though our families worked hard, they also played hard. They knew how to enjoy themselves.
Flinders University Associate Lecturer Yanni Cartledge wrote his thesis on the migration of Aegean Islanders to Australia and the United Kingdom from 1815 to 1945. He helped Mr. Sandanis research his book. Mr. Cartledge coined the term the Porphyry system to describe how the local Greeks helped newer arrivals.
Greeks knew Porphyry as a destination. They would arrive. They had an address on Florence Street where they would stay with a relative, a friend or a sponsor. From there, the Greek community of Porphyry would essentially help with housing, finding work, being a safety net as well for those that had arrived and maybe didn't have exact direction of what they were doing. It was drawing other Greeks in. From there, they would get settled and then dispersed to other parts of Porphyry or to other parts of SA.
Author Nick Sandanis says he's dedicated a chapter of his book to the 7 ship jumpers and their legacies.
I've tracked down all their families. Most of the grandkids are doctors, lawyers, big business people. From the term illegal immigrant to what these 7 people have contributed to Australian society is just amazing.
Vicky Natarfalos with that story from Port Pirie. You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio. After nearly 2 decades in refugee camps, a group of new Australians in regional Victoria has found an innovative way to connect with their adopted country. The Bhutanese Community Farm was created after the arrival of a number of Bhutanese families in the northeast of Victoria to keep the new migrants in touch with their roots and pass down farming and cooking practices to the next generation. But it's proving to be about much more than just food. Wodonga reporter Jason Katsaris put on his gumboots and went for a look.
Walking along the banks of the Murray River in northeastern Victoria at Wodonga, the native gum trees and bushes are interrupted by an outcrop of plants and miniature farm plots. Surrounded by grazing cattle and native birds, discovering this collection of plots and garden beds, complete with shady lanes and climbing vegetables, any wandering tourist would be forgiven for thinking they'd found a farming village in South Asia. It's an initiative from the local Bhutanese community, which now involves over 300 families, all growing their own fruit and vegetables.
We realize that mostly the people, as I told you, the people come from agricultural background. They don't have enough English to share their views and ideas. The idea came from the community. Why not we have got a farm, a plot of farm or somewhere else? Can we ask, can we organize it so we can engage there?
That's Farm Secretary Harker Bister. He helped to start the farm in 2015 after a survey from the community identified the need for somewhere to gather.
Importantly, it is important to have connection with each other, share their culture, share their produce. You know, so this is a sitting place for them. They do work and come back here and sit and share among each other their how they grow their produce, food, back to their country.
But Mr. Bister explained it took some time for farming practices to be relearnt, as the majority of Bhutanese refugees spent nearly 20 years in refugee camps in eastern Nepal before they were resettled in Australia.
We want to rid off from our mental health and trauma, mostly the people from refugee background. They came from refugee background and have a lot of traumas.
For the small cost of water, around $20 a year, families can claim a parcel of land to grow fresh produce, and it's steadily growing in popularity. 6 years after the garden's founding, the board saw a need to include other new migrant groups in the scheme, who, despite coming from vastly different parts of the world, share a common history of farming and food sharing.
The people from different community groups, like they grow different veggies than ours. We grow in our own way, and Filipino grows in their own way. Congolese grows their food in their own way, but we share each other. We share ideas, skills.
Foundation member Bhakti Damala has since farmed alongside Filipino, Indian and Congolese families.
It's more multicultural, more vibrant, it's colorful. Learning culture, learning language. When we see African people, we can say Shantasane or Jumbo or Shawa Shawa. That's a language. We don't have to take a time to go to the language class. We can greeting to the people. We meet the Filipino people, Congolese people. It is more welcoming.
The fruits of all this labour have also empowered all the communities to help the needy in their adopted country, with 6,000 meals donated to local food charities every year.
People build a confidence to come out and talk and make a relation and started to growing connection within the community.
Mr. Muller, who spent 19 years in the same refugee camp as Mr. Bister, said her parents have relished the opportunity to pass down their knowledge and skills in farming.
And when we are in a camp, we have very small hut and we don't have the space. But mom and dad, like over 40s and 50, when they arrive, they really miss it and stuck at home. And they find the way to come out. So this is a great opportunity for our elder people's dad, mom, but they don't need the counselor or therapeutic support when they come and talk to the other people. They have a trust and they have a relationship. It is really helping.
She said the idea of a community farm should be spread to other communities, other towns and other cities, particularly with migrant populations.
Because they grow the vegetable, they share, they don't have to go and buy the expensive vegetables.
Do you think this should be in other places?
That there should be more grow, of these? Yeah, should be grow in the overall all area.
ABC Wodonga reporter Jason Katsaris with that story. A teenager has reeled in the most lucrative catch in Australia, winning the Northern Territory's $1 million fish competition. For the first time in the competition's 9-year history, the NT government has announced a territory angler has won the major prize and caught a tagged barramundi. The competition was set up to lure tourists and fishers to the Northern Territory in the quieter wet season months. Keegan Payne, a 19-year-old from Katherine, today becomes the territory's newest millionaire after snagging the $1 million fish on the Katherine River.
I'm just grateful for it. It's going to help the family out a lot. We're from Katherine, only a small town. Mum's from Kakadu, and Dad's from Queensland. We've been growing up in Katherine for, I think, 28 years now. And, it's pretty hard going for us at the moment with money, but, yeah, now with $1 million, don't have to complain about it.
What are you going to do with the cash?
Well, I'm buying a new boat, the Savo, and maybe the Savo and a new car. So,
tell us how you caught it.
I caught it with a little bit of a live bait with cherrapin, sitting at a spot for about 4 hours.
And what did you do when you saw it?
I actually didn't see it. My little sister spotted it. And we all freaked out and we were over the moon about it, eh? We weren't actually expecting a tag barra at the time. Until her little sister actually asked what it was in the fish, and we told her, and we were freaking out. We nearly crashed the boat, getting back to the boat ramp, but it was good.
So. And I heard you made a phone call.
We made a phone call. We called Dad, and then he called the fella up, whoever does the stuff. So
yeah. What do you think about what are you going to do with $1 million?
Help the family out, going to go buy a new boat and a new car,
Fantastic. So congratulations to the family, to the Payne family, wonderful, and to Keegan, you're a champion. Thanks, everybody.
19-year-old Keegan Payne from Katherine, who caught that $1 million tagged barramundi on the Katherine River. He's the first angler to reel in the top prize in the NT's annual $1 million fish competition, which has been running for 9 years. And that's Australia Wide for this Tuesday. Remember, you can listen to a podcast of this show via the ABC Listen app or by visiting the ABC Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. Have a great evening. I'll be back with you tomorrow.
ABC Listen.